The number 10, more than a number, more than a shirt. The number 10 represents much more than football. From Puskás to Pelé, Maradona and Messi, those wearing it carry the weight of expectation for club and country. But how did those players reach such legendary status? In this fascinating read, it explores the lives of the men, the superstars, who made that number themselves their own. It's a new book by Andy, but I presume it's Bolin, if I get the name right, or Bolin.
That's fine. That's me.
That's you. And I'm delighted to
I always say to people it's like Pollen, but only with a B. That's how then people remember.
Bolin.
There
you go. And you're over in Coatbridge, which we were just saying, which is a place very dear to me because my mother was from there. So there you go.
Absolutely amazing, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's very, family. It's a Spanish family cheese.
It's a very small world. The number 10, why is it so distinctive, so special, do you think, Andy?
I don't know. I've just always been intrigued. As I say in the start of it, intrigued by the weight of the shirt and just the iconic nature of the actual number. I mean, it always seemed just more than a position as well. And the people that carried it seemed to have something about them. That made me go and sort of do the writery thing and go and research. And so many of the guys that you know, people will know about all their, you know, their great successes and their defining moments. But a lot of people will not know half the things that come through and the heartache and the disasters. And, you know, it's really intriguing to know these guys were in the middle of, like, you know, like these moments in games under so much pressure and the country's wanting them to do something. And there were guys that were racially abused, we guys who were, you know, that were beaten up, we guys that had nothing. One of the women, there's a girl, can't say anymore, a woman in at Marta who I found out about Marta a few years ago. And this woman was poor as, I mean, you wouldn't think it was like 2003 or something when she was growing up. But this girl was like, absolute abject poverty, heartbreaking stuff. So there's all that, and you think all these things, all these elements come together, and they're really, I think that's the key thing. It's like a different take. The book's, it's all about the football, of course it is. It's all about the glamour and excitement and all the, you know, the skill and the, you know, the just, it's about obviously the footballers and this moment, but in these key points in their career, and most of them have all had, very few of them have an easy time of it. That's the thing that attracted me to that, and the idea of writing about all my favourite footballers.
Well, of course, for those who don't know, you know, anything about football, where does the number 10 stand play? What's the official position of a number 10?
Well, that's an interesting point because, well, the number 10 would be behind two centre-forwards, two attackers. So they're in a central position. They're in the midfield. But in the last few years, though, because of Pep Guardiola and Klopp and guys like that playing the high press, the number 10 starting to, that was another reason for doing the book, the number 10 is starting to sort of get phased out a bit. It used to be guys like Glenn Hoddle and all that, that would get the ball, Zidane, get the ball down the middle, make things happen, make passes, Modric, get the ball down, look around. So they bring other players into the game. But they're technically in the park, they're probably just behind the striker. And that's their kind of, they're in the centre, they're the heartbeat, they're the drummer, they're the beat, they're the rhythm of the game. They can see it, play that pass, take that amazing free kick. So you've got all these different elements to the number 10. So that's what they would be. They would be in the centre of the park. A conductor. Imagine him as a conductor in the park. That's what they'd be like.
Yeah, sort of a midfield general, if you, and seeing what everybody's doing and spurring them on. Is the number 10 then often as well becomes the captain? I mean, you think, so obviously, Maradona, for example, who's just sort of muzzled his way through.
It appears that way, but I think it's just, and I think after Messi and Maradona and all these guys, they seem to get changed a wee bit. I think maybe because time's passed and footballs, everyone loves football so much now that they're starting to analyse it in a different way. And I think before, the 10 was just a number. It was just, it wasn't really that much, that important. Like Pelé, I think maybe Pelé probably started the glamour of it and the actual, you know, the significance of it. But the actual, the number itself and the position that the players are playing, all that pales into insignificance whenever you think about the actual, the focus and the drive and the importance of the number, just in terms of sheer guts and determination and skill. And I think, I don't know. I think it's easy. Technically, it's just a number so that the FA or FIFA or UEFA can register a player. When you think about it, that's all it is. It's a good point. It's just a stat, but it's evolved. I think there's so many outlets now, and it's evolved into something special for me.
And it's also interesting you mentioned Pelé having the number 10, because if you like, sort of Pelé is the groundbreaker who makes football a little bit sort of a little bit sexy, a little bit fun, because before then, with the greatest deference to sort of the Hungarian teams and whoever who went before, but it was a bit sort of staid, wasn't it?
They were all black and white as well.
Exactly,
what was that all about?
Exactly. You know, I mean, we think Mexico 1970 and that glorious. I mean, how many times did you play that one on Sabutio? You know,
oh geez,
kids ask your parents.
Oh, I remember Sunday that I grew up beside had the Brazil as a beautiful team with the Brazil strips and floodlights. And you're like, what? But I remember growing up with Pelé, and it was Pelé when he was rounding down his career, and he was at New York Cosmos. Remember that? He went to the Cosmos, and I was sitting in North Lanarkshire looking at this guy, and I always remember I had this book. I've got it beside me right now, Robert L. Fish. It's called Pelé, My Life in the Beautiful Game. And I read it. You should see the status in it. I'll actually share it on social. I'll put it on Twitter. I saw there was a tweet earlier. I'll go on and share the picture of the book. The book's like, the book's decrepit, but it's an incredible book. And the guy, this Pelé was just, his dad was a brilliant footballer and broke his leg. So he always knew from an early age that it was fraught. And his mother didn't want him to be a footballer. But anyway, Pelé, at that time, he was just at that point in his career when he was rounding down. But he was just like, he was even at that level playing on AstroTurf. He's probably in his 30s, but then he's 35 or something. And he was just outstanding. I couldn't believe how good he was. And then I started from there. I was maybe about 10 or something. And he was just outstanding as a footballer. And I couldn't believe it. And then you start to get into football and you start to read the books about them all and you see, you know, and this guy in the number 10 with his chest out, and he's only 5'8" or I think he was 5'7" or 5'8", Pelé. He was very short, but his bearing was, he had a presence. But his, all the things that he did in the park, Charles, all those things he did, he was coached. Everything that he did, every goal he scored, every move he made, everything, every, the way he ran with the ball, his father, and then this other older guy who took the team, was like he was a former captain of Brazil or something that took the youth team, and they trained him, and all his technique and all his the way he plays and the way he dribbled with the ball, just the way he headed the ball, how he headed the ball properly, it was all coaching. And you don't think that when you see these, you just think these guys are born with all this great ability.
But it's the thing, isn't it? Because obviously all that coaching, so it becomes second nature. And people say, oh, well, they've got that. It's in the genes. It's from playing football in the favelas and whatever else, or on the beach at wherever you might be. But it's the thing where they've done all the hard work, all the training. Well, so when
that's a really good point. Yes, that's a really good point. And Zico, I think I mentioned this in the book. Zico, the Brazilian, who was also, he was called a wee bit the non-PC now, but he was called the White Pelé. And he was a fantastic footballer. Liverpool fans will remember he played them out in Japan in the World Club Championship, and he gave them it was guys like Dalglish and Souness and all that, and he tore them apart. Sorry, Liverpool. But whenever Zico was a kid, he famously put a tracksuit top over the crossbar, and he wouldn't go home until he hit the top 10 times in a row. He could be there for hours and hours. His family came out to get him in. And then as a player, and then later as a coach, he compared the technique, just exactly what you're saying, the technique of passing and heading, free kicks, just to muscle memory. It was all a mechanical thing. It was like brushing your teeth. That was his quote. That's what he said. So you're spot on.
Because when it comes to one of those situations where the ball, you know, you're in the World Cup final and the ball falls at your feet, you don't want to think, oh, I'm going to hit it on the outside of my laces or whatever. It just
muscle
comes
memory.
Muscle
Bang.
Memory.
It's just practice.
It's also interesting as well, isn't it? Because, I mean, looking at the rather wonderful front cover, the number 10, although we're saying that you have to muscle around the park, I mean, if I remember correctly, Zidane was a bit of a unit, wasn't he? But, you know, you look at Maradona, you look at Messi, and you look at Pelé, and they weren't big guys. I mean, and you think especially
guys.
Messi, because he was told so many times that he was too small to cut
incredible,
it.
Incredible. He had to do it. He had to inject himself for 2 years with growth hormone treatment. And one of the reasons why he came over to Barcelona was because the team he was at the time wouldn't pay the money. Rosario, I think it was, they wouldn't pay the money to get him, give him the injection. So Barcelona eventually decided to Gary, it was 2 years. He was only 12. He was a wee kid. He was only 13 or 14. He's shy, and you've got the other end of the world. But again, that drive, that determination. But they're all small. Maradona as well. Maradona was just, as you say, they were a unit, weren't they? They were, I don't know if, Maradona and that, the goal of the set, I don't want to bring it up, against English, but that actual goal, the goal of the century, that, when you watch him, he pirouettes around guys and then he finds this, he puts the afterburners on and it's his thighs and it's his power. But Maradona and Ronaldinho were the two who probably worked least at their game. Maradona had to be kept fit all the time. He got a lot of private coaching and a lot of running because he wasn't fit enough. And when he was fit and on his game, he was just offed. Unbelievable. And it was great for Messi as well in the World Cup. I actually predicted that in the book, and they were going to take it out. And I argued with the publisher. He goes, now you need to keep that in. I had written before Maradona won the Qatar World Cup 2022 that This guy's got a bit of the magic about him. It's like a scriptwriter's dream. Don't be expecting him just to sort of go like a damp squib. He's going to do something and ended up winning the World Cup. And it was about one of the best World Cup finals ever.
Yeah, and exactly. And that's the thing, isn't it? When we may say, oh, well, football and the whole bits, should they have the World Cup? The whole problem was with FIFA. And then something like that happens because everybody was rooting for Messi at the end because it was the perfect finale.
It was magical because you knew, but then all the other guys like Pele and Maradona, they were all, for me anyway, the top, and maybe you're going to ask me this later on, but Pele was number one, Maradona was number two, but Messi was maybe, it wasn't in the top three for me, but the more I wrote about him, the more I learned about him, the more I understood all the achievements at Barcelona, and then what he did with the world, the actual team, the Argentinian manager came in, and he totally changed it, and he was just like, he was just a guy that took all the youth side, come through the system, the Argentina FA, and he was a brilliant coach, but what he did was he got everyone else to do his running. They got everyone else to protect Messi, and he said, I don't want you to run about anymore. You stay up there. There's your office. Between the posts is your office. You get in there. It was amazing what they did, and what a story, as you say. It was just fantastic.
And the other thing with Messi is he became, if you like, more Argentinian for the World Cup because he was seen by many for Argentina as being
Spanish,
a bit too not Argentinian enough. So he suddenly became very, very Argentinian with the way he was the way he was talking.
He's split opinion in Argentina. I did a lot of research. I mentioned it in the book. I won't waste it. But there's bits in it where at points in his career they just were horrible to him. Half of them loved him, and they were their Messi. They loved him. We Lionel from Rosario or whatever. He's just this wee, a good guy. They all loved him. But then you got other guys. Whenever Argentina weren't doing well, it was always him that got the blame. So he would be. Oh, look, he doesn't even sing a national anthem, and they really turned on him. And then near the end, during COVID, they won the South American equivalent to the sort of European championships. They won that. And then they came in off that. I remember telling all my friends to back Argentina, and a lot of them put money on it. I said, Messi's going to, honestly, this team are brilliant. They've got McAllister playing for them. They've got a lot of power in there. Honestly, what a story. Can you believe the publisher were going to take that out? It looks as if you just went in and put it in. It goes, no, I didn't.
Does the pressure of being the number 10, does it weigh heavily on the shoulders? And also, we mentioned Maradona. I mean, there is a guy with wonderful gifts, but well-publicised, problems off the pitch, and then going to Napoli, which was one of the more interesting moves. I mean, they all react to the pressure in different ways, don't they? And Zidane's headbutt in the World Cup final,
I don't know if I never submitted this. I'd do some rights articles and newspaper things, and I had this idea about, I'd be allowed to talk about Succession briefly, Succession, the TV show, massive show in the UK and America. You know Succession, don't you?
We do indeed, yeah. Everybody's been glued to it, yes.
I don't want to waste it for anyone, but I actually wrote an article, and it was about Zidane and Succession. Succession ended the way it had to end, really. I won't say what happened, and with Zidane, his career had to end like that, because if you read what I've written about Zidane and his career, he had that in his game, and that's what drove him. That's what you get. And coaches, opposition coaches used to say to their players, get into his head, get into his head, because we can't beat them with it unless in any way he gets sent off. And it's just incredible that was his last act in football as well. It was the last ever. And you're sitting watching it, and he scored a penalty in about the 7th minute. At the very beginning of that game, didn't he?
And then you see him walking down the tunnel past the World Cup,
taking the captain's armband off and just taking his tape off. It was so sad. What a photograph that is.
Is there something in the DNA then? Even though these are such disparate characters, do you think that?
I think so. One of the things in an interview I did for a newspaper in Scotland, I was talking about Maradona, and the guy made a really good point. The guy I was speaking to, and I said Maradona's sort of his head and the way he's made up is more than keeping me. Instead of talking about football, it's like a psychological study. Do you know, if you feel like you're describing a bipolar or a schizophrenic footballer or something like that. And it's just, his survival mechanism was to exist as two distinct characters. And the more I thought about this, the more I thought, that's so true. Because they always say the people that know about him and really have sort of studied him and know all his career and all that. Diego, he's like the lovable son, Diego, his sort of brother, father. And then you've got Maradona, the footballer, will do anything to win. You know, the cheat and the drug addict and sort of two concepts, one person. That was my starting point for Maradona's chapter. Just, and I think it's true about him because he was fantastic whenever he was fit and he was healthy and his mind was in the right place, but there was two different. I mean, even, I think it's Gary Lineker made a really good quote about him when his death, and he said, you know, all the stuff with the hand of God and all that, but then minutes later to score the best goal that's ever been scored. You know, it's just, it's like the two sides of the same guy.
And also the thing is that now we live in a footballing environment where everybody gets, you know, because it's social media, so they have to calm down a bit and they get coached. But you know, back in the day, and we're talking 70s or 60s with Pele, you know, basically 80s, beginning of the 70s, 80s with Maradona, but they were just literally flung out there, and there are, you know, these are people from very poor areas, and suddenly they find themselves an awful lot of money, and you know, we going to do about it.
And hangers on as well. You watch that Maradona documentary when he's out in Napoli. And I mean, Napoli were like the equivalent to, they would be like, I don't know, Everton, maybe Everton now. They were fifth or sixth in the league whenever he joined them. And he dragged them. And they won two titles. It was the first time they'd won the title, I think, whenever he was there. It was just an incredible story. But in that documentary, it's actually claustrophobic because it's amazing what they do. It's all reportage. And they just drop them in the middle of it. And you're like, what is going on here? And you're thinking exactly what you just said there, Giles. It's like there's a protection now for a lot of the players, a lot of the top players like Neymar and Messi and all that. They're all protected and they've got people around them. They're like a CEO of a company now. Maradona was just thrown in there. Didn't even know where Napoli was and all that.
Yeah, if you think about how, you know, what Napoli's, apart from the pizza, you know, Napoli's got quite an interesting, shall we say, some quite interesting neighbourhoods and whatever, and so obviously it wasn't the perhaps...
Is this going out in Italy?
Did you do a top, because you just said so-and-so didn't make it, did you do a top three then, or how can you rate them? Because they're so, I mean, they all bring different things, don't they, and it's all of their time.
And then you've got to say, you've got guys like Pele who played in parts that were like ditches and holes and all that. And then you've got Messi playing in bowling greens every week. So it's hard for, I did it just purely as a football fan and as a kid. And I'm thinking Pele for me, Maradona, then Messi. But interestingly, there was a bone of contention because I picked a squad 18 and also put Marta in. And Marta's there on merit, not because it's some sort of, you know, trying to be right on. She's there because her story's incredible. It's like a Hollywood movie if you get a chance to read the book.
Is this the Afghanistan?
No, she's from Marta. She's the girl from Brazil, and she's from like an area out in Brazil that's like, it would put parts of, I don't know, it's just a really, really rough bit of Brazil. I'm trying to remember the name of it. And she came from this area, and she was just dirt poor. I think her quote was, if my mum bought me football boots, the family wouldn't eat. That kind of a level, and she wasn't making it up, you know, and then, If you look at Modric as well, Modric saw his grandfather. His grandfather was executed by the Serbians. And then his dad brought his dead body into the, he was 10 and he sees all this happening. And then he's out playing football. They moved to a safe hotel in Zadar or something it was called. And they moved him into there and he's playing football with his other wee refugees, really, guys for the war, like moved because of war and bombs are falling on them. And I said to somebody recently, you know, how are you going to be nervous walking on a football park if you're used to bombs and all that? And you've seen all this. They're just a different, you know, that's why guys like Modric keep on playing for the country as well. They've got real, anyway, what we're talking about, Marta and talking about poverty and then drive. I can't remember what we're talking about. What was you were saying again?
But just saying that the different skills that they sort of bring to it, and if there's something in the DNA, and also, you know, who your squad was. Anybody from the British Isles or the Republic make it in? Because obviously we're Spain.
Yes, well, Glenn Hoddle was a hero growing up, so Glenn's in. Glenn is a classic number 10, and he should have played a lot more for England as well, but he went to France, and then he really became like a... They appreciated him, so Hoddle's in. And I actually made a executive decision to leave out Kylian Mbappe.
Okay.
And Mario Kempes, they were my two. I actually wrote chapters about the two, and I've got full chapters written about them. But I had to make it 18. I made it a squad of 18, and I had to drop. But I put in Wayne Rooney. Because of the amount of goals he scored and because of where he was from and the abuse he got. And just like, again, and then at Manchester United, if you see some of his play, he was just unbelievable. And he's a record holder, I think, till recently as well with Harry Kane. I put in Wayne instead of Mbappe. I had to phone up Mbappe and tell him he wasn't in. He was raging. Sorry, Kelly, to be man, you made the squad. You took the huff of me. See, that's it. I'm leaving him. I'm going to Real Madrid. He hung up the phone. He was raging.
That was the thing that sort of turned him over, was it? Just that one thing.
That was the straw that broke his back.
The other cracking number 10 was Kempes, Mario Kempes, yeah. When he was Argentina. I'm not sure what age you are, but I think maybe the reference points, your cultural reference points are kind of a similar. Anyway, Mario Kempes in 1978 was just like long dark hair and just this left foot and playing with all the ticker tape in Argentina and all that, and it was just an incredible World Cup. But obviously, you know now that Argentina were winning it no matter what happened. But we won't get into that. Just that's another book. But he was close. He was like Harry Kane. He was a goal scoring number 10, not to be confused with a playmaking number 10 who would be in midfield, opening up, playing, providing. So that's why I left Kempes out. But Kylian and Papi should be all right, should have been in. And I was kind of glad he didn't win the World Cup and Messi won it, because it justified my selection of Messi. So,
and as you're on, and we're in Spain, and obviously Scotland v Spain, that must have been quite an evening for you.
That was amazing. I mean, the Spanish team, we still go into games thinking, you know, under promise, over deliver. But Stevie Clark's a really good manager. He's very like the Argentinian coach. He's just very methodical, very... keeps things simple, keeps the squad happy. And Scotland's got loads of guys that are playing the Premiership now. So that, you know, but it's looking good for Scotland. But we play against Haaland tomorrow night. So that'll be a bit. Hope he's still celebrating and drunk. falling off the team coach and all that. Exactly. He's top off.
Exactly. The book is called The Number 10, More Than a Number, More Than a Shirt. It's by Andy Bolland, who we're speaking to today. Andy, if people want to find you on the socials or the websites, where can they track
Facebook,
you down?
Facebook, Twitter, at Nirvana Diary is my Twitter handle. There's a story behind that.
Uh-huh.
But you can find out later on. I'm on Twitter. I'm on Facebook. I'm on. Yep. So you'll find me there. I'm rubbish at social media.
Well,
I'm absolutely terrible. I think I'm giving me age away. I just can't. I just don't like it.
And also the book. Sorry, go.
I was going to say I was growing up, if you talked about yourself, people say, "Yeah, you are." And bring you, now the young ones, they're all Mozart and Picasso and all that. You're like, no, they're not. They're rubbish.
The book will also be available as a virtual download from a virtual bookstore as well on TRE.radio. The book is called The Number 10, More Than a Number, More Than a Shirt. We're going to run out of time, Andy, so it's been great to speak to you. But
absolutely fantastic. Andy, Paul, good luck.
Thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks, Europe. Bye-bye.